Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Hey, 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 welcome to 2026. This is Them Before Us Radio. We are so grateful that you are kicking off the new year thinking about marriage, family, and specifically children. That is what we are here to do, is to center your mind around the least of these, especially as it relates to trending topics about marriage and family and children. They are the vulnerable that we are called to defend. So we spend an hour every week on the weekends highlighting how it is that we can step up and be their champion. We're going to kick off this year the way we do with all of our radio programs, and that is with a little bit of Bible time. I have had a bit of a break from my regular devotionals and decided to memorize some scripture. And by some, I mean just a couple verses, because I am an old lady and memorization comes hard these days. But I am absolutely inspired by the book of Nehemiah. Them Before Us is spearheading a national coalition to challenge gay marriage, which is like rebuilding a wall of a city that has sat in ruins for 10 years. And thank God, literally thank God, we have an incredible coalition of organizations, individuals, church leaders, and influencers who are going to build this wall with us. But I will tell you, like so much of what Nehemiah experiences in terms of his calling, his task, the organization that is before him, the opposition that he faces, and the glory that God receives when he succeeds, it just speaks to me so much. So this is the verse that I've been committing to memory. It is, the God of heaven himself will prosper us. Therefore, we, his people, will arise and build. And I just love that because it puts the credit where it's due, which is God as the mover, God as the one that is going to allow the house to be built, but we don't sit around doing nothing. We arise. We, his people, arise and build. So you see that, like, there's both sides, and Nehemiah does this so well. He so often recognizes God's role in this project and man's role in the project. You know, later on, he says, when they were facing opposition and attacks and threats, he said, "We prayed to the Lord and we posted a guard." Like, he saw both sides of that coin. What is God's job here that we cannot do and should not try? And what is our job where we would be sinning if we sat back and said, "Oh, we don't have any role here." So that's what I love for 2026. You probably have some kind of project, some mission, some tasks that you feel that God is putting before you. If it is something that he has given to you, you too can claim, I'm not a name it and claim it girl, but this is a verse that you can hold on to. The God of heaven himself will prosper you. Therefore, you, his people, should arise and build. I am here with Jen, my training director. We're going to hit a few of the stories that have interested us over the last week. Before we do, Jen, any thoughts on Nehemiah in general or that verse specifically?
That verse made me think of a pretty well-established principle, I think, in scripture that men make a lot of plans and try to do and go about different things. But at the end of the day, it's God's will that will prevail, or it's God's help that will make the plans we're making work or not work. I just looked up, based on what you had shared, I looked up Proverbs 16 talks about this: the heart of man plans his way, but the Lord establishes his steps. And then Proverbs 19:21 says, many are the plans in a man's heart, but it's the Lord's purpose that prevails. And I know you lead us well at Them Before Us, talking about, you know, we can desire to do, we're going to do a global takeover, and that means we're going to go to this country, or we're going to talk to this person, or we have to get on this podcast. And we might think, here's the certain things we need to be doing to get our plans in order. And I think there's nothing wrong with vision and here's the direction we're going. But you lead us well to understand too that we need to be open. If God's directing a different way, or if something succeeds, it's because God decided so, not because you, as the figurehead, or you, because of a personality, made something happen. And I think that humility is really important for us going forward, is we're proud of the successes we had in 2025, but I think we try to keep that humility of none of this matters for anything if our moral integrity gets compromised, or if we go about it in the wrong way, then it will be for naught, even if we think we have power or prestige or influence or whatever.
We have a lot more influence than we deserve at Them Before Us. If you look at our mailing list or our bank account, you would be stunned that we would have this level of influence, that we at Them Before Us would be spearheading a national coalition of all of the major conservative organizations, pro-family organizations, Christian nonprofits in the country to retake the institution of marriage, which has been, which has crumbled as a result of foreign occupation, right, by an ideology that is fundamentally anti-child and anti-human, that we at Them Before Us would have a seat on the advisory board for Jordan Peterson's new project, the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship, partnering on a $1 million full-length documentary with focus on the family that is going to be a global tool to defend children around the world. You know, I would say about to launch a project that we pray will be the primary agitator against the child-hating organization, the Human Rights Campaign, launching a national database that grades every state on how well they protect children that can be used for the sake of like citizenship, citizen advocacy, or policymakers, the kind of partnerships and influences that we have. Given that we're a staff of like 5 plus some great part-timers and contractors, it would blow your mind at how visible we are. You know, I was in line at Costco today while, you know, they were checking out my groceries, dictating a response to a large Christian news platform that wanted a quote on a news headline that had to do with IVF. Like, God has allowed us to be what I feel like is omnipresent on these topics, despite the fact that we are very small and very lean. And so when people say, wow, you've accomplished so much, we really can say, for real, to God be the glory. For real. Because not to us, not to the 5 of us plus awesome contractors. It is to God. It is His hand that is on us, that has allowed us to do this work. And we will arise and build. But it is the God of heaven Himself who will allow us to continue to prosper in that work. Well, I want to turn first to this story that just came out called 40-year Harvard professor pens scathing piece on school's exclusion of white males, anti-Western trends. And this is a professor that has been tenured for decades. And through 2021, all of the wokeness and the DEI that had infused the institution, the egregious ways that the school dealt with COVID and the lockdowns and education, and I'm sure continuing into the blatant anti-conservative bias that has manifested itself in a targeted rejection of young men, specifically young white men. He penned this letter, in essence, fully taking down the one of the flagship universities of the country. So, Jen, tell me a little bit about this titled piece, Why I'm Leaving Harvard, that was published in Compact Magazine.
Yeah, so history professor James Hankins talked about, you know, he had tried to leave or wanted to leave as of 2021, but kind of fulfilled his retirement plan to step out. But he just talked about basically that these major institutions that we would have said, these are the pinnacle of education in America or Western civilization right now, are just completely captured by bad ideology. Some of the things he talked about that were very disturbing that I think kind of connect to some of the things we talk about were that the anti-white male bias was so obvious. He said he had kids who worked for him, you know, as like grad students, and they were applying for different things that could not get a job or get accepted to the program at the next stage just because of the color of their skin.
Even though they were perfect. They were like the top achieving students. They had done their research papers on this. They had done all the different, they had all the credentials. They had all the academic, like they were the perfect fit. Mm-hmm. And they'd be rejected because they were white. Keep going.
Yeah. White and male with the most merit, like an mm-hmm. objective standard, the best candidate for the position could not get it. Because the color of their skin and their gender. And I think he said, he talked about interviewing or kind of asking around a bunch of different people. And the only person he could point to, a white male that had been able to get a position, was someone who identified as trans. So it was a woman pretending to be male, was the only person who could get a job and get past that. And just, I was wanting your take on this, just is so bad when we think about the future of civilization, people getting married, people having jobs. When you look at white men, which is the majority in this country, and they're so disenfranchised, so beat down, you cannot be, you're considered the most evil person there is in the United States if you're a white male. The only way they can get back in the oppression Olympics is if they identify as trans, which is happening a lot. But this is going to hurt marriage and family. That's what's interesting about it to me, is men that are so dejected, what's the point of trying to go get educated and get better jobs when we're hated so widely? It feels like that ramification seems really like a really big deal.
At the risk of angering everybody listening to this, because really, I think that some people might disagree with what I'm about to say. Men need to be esteemed for something that they deliver to the world in a way that women do not. I love being recognized for the work that I'm doing, but it is not a core need for me the way that I believe it is for a majority of men. At the core of what it means to be a guy, a boy, a man, it is feeling like I have something the world needs. I came through in a pinch. I delivered the goods. They needed me for that. It was so hard, but I was able to do it. I was able to nail the GRE and get into that grad school. I was able to deliver the final blow on my debate team. I was able to score the winning touchdown. Like, men need to know. I mean, my husband was a pastor for decades, and he wanted, when he sat down after sermon, he would look at me, in essence, like, did I deliver? Was I able to do what the room needed? There is something about men to know that they're valuable, yes, for who they are, but what they can contribute to the world and for an entire system like academia and the corporate world and so much of lower education as well. It was scaled against them. No matter how much merit they had, they could not succeed in so many of these fields. And this article is on the heels of another Compact magazine article that really detailed the discrimination against young white men, specifically in the field of journalism and in the field of law and academia as well, and how you could see over the course of about 10 years, the numbers skewing heavily away from young white male hires and towards anybody who wasn't that, any woman, any minority, any sexual, new sexual label, they would get hired, but not young white men. It actually is cruel. I think that this was a form of cruelty because it really like stabbed at the core of what all men need. It would be just like if there had been a decades-long campaign to tell every woman that she was ugly and unlovable. And everywhere they turned, you're ugly and unlovable. Nope, you'll never be beautiful, and you're not worthy of security and devotion. That's the equivalent of what I feel like the corporate world has done to men over the last 10 years.
Wow, that's crazy. I was just thinking about over the holidays, I was hanging out with some of the kids in my family, and one of the boys, we were out on a walk. He's about 6 or 7, and he wanted to jump over a ditch. And he was kind of asking, oh, can I do it? Am I allowed to? And his parents probably lean a little more toward don't get dirty and don't do that. And I was like, yeah, go. And his sister was like, well, what if he falls down? I was like, then he gets dirty. Like, I don't, you know, it wasn't like this big, crazy thing. But even him jumping over and me being like, oh, good job. That was awesome. Hey, see if you can jump back and challenging
did he make
and pushing.
It?
Oh,
did
yeah.
He make-
yeah.
And how did he feel when he made it?
He was proud. He was so proud. And he was telling yeah. people that he yeah. had done it on the walk after.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Kids need that.
You know, we talk about, some of our listeners are going to be familiar with the book Love and Respect, which was one of the first kind of marriage books that identified that men and women have different core needs in a marital relationship. Women need to be loved and they need to feel secure. Men need to feel respected. And men and women both need help delivering this. Sometimes men don't feel like they want to love their wives because, gosh, she's really naggy or she's really needy or something like that. And women don't feel like they want to respect their husbands because she feels like she's doing all of the work and he comes home and he puts his feet up on the couch and he falls asleep. And there's something where we need supernatural help, both of us, doing that for our spouses. But it really does highlight that men and women are different in these key areas of their own humanity, their own femininity and masculinity, and the level of overt, cruel discrimination that we have seen. Let's be very clear, at the hands of DEI policy, diversity, equity, and inclusion, which is an attack on meritocracy and an attack ultimately on the oppressors, which is anybody white, male, and heterosexual. It is disproportionately fallen on young men, and it's something that I pray in 2026 we're able to make right.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, here with my training director at Them Before Us, Jen Friesen. We are talking about all things family, and we're so glad that you're with us for the kickoff of 2026. We want this to be a year where your marriage is stronger, your relationship with your children is stronger, and your ability to advocate on behalf of children across our nation is stronger as well. So, Jen, what is up next for us on segment two?
Well, before we hop into our next news story, Katie, I'd love to just hear from you. We just went through the holidays. You had Christmas, we had New Year's, and I know your husband was back from deployment, and now you're experiencing something I think a lot of military spouses and families experience, is sort of that, what is that reintegration of, you know, dad or mom who's been deployed back into life like? But yeah, just tell us about how your holiday was and the importance of building holiday memories with your family.
Holiday was... okay, magical might be too strong of a word, but it was wonderful because we did get our dad and husband back about 7 days before Christmas. And so we definitely had the, oh yay, he's back. One amazing relief was when the garbage disposal broke and everything under the sink was leaking 2 days before Christmas, I thought, thank God, I don't have to deal with this alone. So that was wonderful. I think the funnest thing about it is... we had almost all of our kids home on Christmas, and then we got the other one and her husband back a couple days later. But when we were young, young parents, my husband had just gotten out of seminary, and I think that we were very strict. I think appropriately strict in terms of discipline, but when it came to Christmas, we were not fun. We thought, this is about worshiping Christ. We're going to worship Christ. This isn't going to be about presents. This is going to be about the true reason for the season. And so we would give gifts. They would be minimal, but we made sure that we read the entire Christmas story ahead of time, including Old Testament prophecy, all of it. I mean, so it's like there were a lot of hurdles before our kids could get to the point where they could like open stockings or presents or whatever. And over the few years, we just really relaxed. And we thought, you know what? We want this to be a time where we connect with our kids. Christmas actually ended up being one of the quietest times of our year because neither of us have believing parents and neither of those sets of believing parents lived near us. So it was always just our family. And we just got more and more fun through the years. So what that looks like these days is the kids wake up to the Hallelujah chorus blaring at 7:30, which is something we've done for a long time, probably 15 years. But now they don't just wake up and sit down and read the Christmas story. They wake up to usually dad in the kitchen in a Santa suit, cooking pancakes. And then very soon after that, the Hallelujah chorus will flip to like Cotton Eye Joe. And then we're all dancing in the kitchen together. This year we added Mrs. Claus to the mix. And she also was whooping it up in the kitchen. And then we do still do the Christmas story. And our kids now, they love it and they're fine. And they're like, well, we always learn something new because we end up reading scripture for probably 45 minutes or an hour. And our kids used to hate that we would even read the genealogies. They're like, oh my gosh, when can we, do we have to read the whole genealogy? And of course, my husband was like, yes, we need to read the genealogy. Now we have turned it into a genealogy reading contest. We've done this for the last 5 years or so, where we see who can read everything the fastest with the fewest number of mistakes in the pronunciation. And now it's like Faust, the greatest Faust honor is the person that can get through. Our third child won for the first time this year after much practice and preparation. He tripped up where a lot of us do, which is Salmon, not salmon, but Salmon. He lost about 3 seconds on that one, but able to regain his footing and came out on top. So it was just a wonderful Christmas time. And then of course, gift giving is great and the meal is great, but it is a day where we laugh so much together and we are just, it's just a very slow, wonderful day. It's just gotten better and better. So anyway, if you're a young parent and you're listening to this, I would just say, go all in on the fun. It doesn't have to be hyper material. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about hyper connection, hyper laughter, massive memories. And if you're on that debate of like Santa Claus, no Santa Claus, I would say embrace C.S. Lewis's godly imagination and understand that that's a really wonderful opportunity to present the wonder of Christ in a way that is perfectly developmentally deliverable to young kids. What about you, Jen? Did you have any fun kind of Christmas memories from this year?
You know, it's interesting because I'm in a blended family now, and so it comes with complexity for sure. But I think the older I'm getting, the more I'm trying to be intentional with how I approach the holidays. I know for my dad's house, he's not a particularly decorative guy. And my sister and I made a plan to, we basically brought the Christmas tablecloths, bought some stuff for a centerpiece, had the fancy, but had the, you know, decorative plastic plates. We planned the meal. And I just have to go in with a positive attitude to say, I'm not going to think about the things of like, oh, well, I have to do this versus, you know, like, it's not that sometimes my dad would be intentional about setting stuff up. He doesn't necessarily think about it that way. But I can go in with a positive attitude and an intentionality to set things up. And it was especially fun because we had more kids in the mix celebrating this year. And one of the things we do almost every year now is basically I wrote out the Christmas story in a play form. Mm-hmm. And I just made it funny. And there's sound effects and there's a narrator. And my mom and stepdad are super into it. So they make us read it every year, which I do eye roll a little bit. It definitely needs like an AI historical update. But then when we read it, we had some extended family that we're not super close to that joined in. And at the end of it, we all just kind of crack up. And it's a funny, fun way to read the Christmas, think about the Christmas story. So I love that. And yeah, our family's always been super generous with wanting to give each other gifts. And it's not a big deal if someone can't in 1 year with finances or whatever. But that's, everyone's super generous. And so that's a really fun part. And what you were saying just made me think about sometimes maybe parents or some of us think intentionality means it has to be really serious or like don't screw around, or to put the main thing means the fun can't happen until later. And I was thinking about how God instituted so many festivals and celebrations. You really get a picture from scripture that God likes partying and remembering things and using parties, food, activities as a way to communicate really important things. But I don't think you get a picture that God is like, doesn't want to have fun. It's that this is important. It should be intentional. And here's a fun party with food where you're not allowed to work for, you know, X, whatever. You have to party. That's the rules. And I love that. And so that can be a tough balance. The intentionality is really important. But like you said, fun and joy. Your family should not dread that we have to read the Bible together. It should be an exciting, fun, how can we, it's the most interesting story of all time. If we're making it boring, that sucks. That's like misrepresenting God's story. So.
Yeah, it's fun to develop these memories and these traditions with our kids because we didn't have a whole lot from our own childhoods to bring in. But I think that some of our kids will take the ones that we've created and pass them on to their kids, which is very, very fun. We totally thought it's worth investing in a Mrs. Claus suit because, you know, we could have grandkids in the next couple of years. We're like, we would not mind having a little pop in on Christmas morning with like Santa and Mrs. Claus when we get generation 3 of Fausts around, which maybe won't be too long from now, which is very fun to think about. Well, yeah. We wanted to cover in our second story here, this book, 10 Things I Learned from Writing a Book on Motherhood by Nadia Williams. And she is critiquing this post-Christian anthropology that treats people as valuable only when they are productive or efficient. And this is really, I've noticed this so much, right? You see this in all of the major conversations about abortion or euthanasia or what to do with a prenatal diagnosis for a child that might have a disability. She presents motherhood not as some romantic fantasy or social problem. Okay, those are two different extremes. Like, oh, this is motherhood and it's like the best thing ever. And which it is, but it's also like most good things, it will burden you in very real ways. But she also doesn't frame it as a social problem, right? Something that should be avoided. She rather looks at it as a demanding but formative calling that exposes what a society truly believes about people and love and meaning. So Jen, what did you pull from this kind of article about what she learned from motherhood?
Yeah, I liked that Williams came across as an intellectual, very smart about Greek and Greek literature, ancient literature, and she's a homeschooling mom. And so she's in the thick of it. I think she said she had some older teens and a 6-year-old was, I think, her youngest. And so while she can still be philosophical about and sound really smart about a lot of the things that are very important, she also then was talking about, you know, you're going to lose a lot of sleep. And she's like, I thought I was losing sleep staying up studying all night in grad school. She's like, that doesn't compare to me losing sleep having 3 or 4 kids. But how losing sleep is a sacrifice and it's worth it for what you're doing, which is raising humans. So many of her, it's 10 things. There's 10 points. So many of them were so good. I like that she said we need Christian humanists. And I think what she means by that is Christians in the humanities, talking about philosophy, talking about anthropology. Is anthropology is the store, or is it the study of what human meaning?
Yes, it is. It's both. But okay. Anthropology, the store, spells it differently.
Okay, with an IE. But we need Christians that are willing to talk about philosophy, why it matters that we're humans. What we think about God impacts what we think about humans. She talks about the Imago Dei, the idea of being made in God's image, is under direct threat. Christians are really the only ones who are defending humanity. And we talk about this at Them Before Us. When you have sort of a guiding principle, it helps you answer all the questions. So for a Christian, the fact that a human is made in God's image answers a lot of the questions. Should you kill a human at its earliest stages? Should you kill them in a lab? No, because it's a human made in the image of God. At the end of someone's life, they've lost functionality. They're struggling with mental illness or they have dementia. Well, can we end their life? No, because they're made in the image of God. And so the way we use every child has natural rights that guides our principles and Them Before Us, you know, we have these guiding principles. What did you think about the ones that she said, you know, your experience as a wife and mom, faithfulness in small things, you know, those filling, what analogy did she use? You know, moving sand, you know, you might have to fill that bucket up a teaspoon at a time. It's very draining sometimes, but those little moves of faithfulness really build what you need to build into your children.
I have get to think about that a little more now that my children are moving into adulthood. For example, you know, my oldest is married. The two boys are still at home in high school, but my 20-year-old is mid-launch. Like she loves being home. She loves being with us, but I can see the independence. I can see the separation, the wonderful, necessary separation. And I do look back and I go, I can see, you know, now that she's home, her boyfriend is visiting too a bit. So I can see her kind of interacting with him very appropriately for their stage of, you know, relationship and everything. But the way that she speaks respectfully, you know, even if she might disagree, or how she will look to his needs first before her own, the habits, you know, of waking up and reading scripture, even if it's a holiday and like the house is in chaos and you know, like I think that those are little scoops of sand that at the time you think, what is this? You don't think that it's going to have some kind of drastic, dramatic, long-term effect, but it very much is the kind of thing like what you do for your children, before your children, and who you are with your children is going to be it's going to be the default posture that they take for better or worse, right? And we can override what it is that our parents give us, but it is something that has to be overridden. It will end up being the thing that they automatically assume to do or to be, unless some other force, for better or worse, comes and overrides it. So it's interesting watching her as a young woman move into a world where I can see what I typically call like a short-term like death for a long-term harvest. Like motherhood, especially motherhood, I think a lot of ways, is a giving of yourself in this way, just like this article talks about, where it is demanding, self-sacrificial, but the fruitfulness, the long-term fruitfulness, the harvest It goes on and on. If you can put the hard work in, if you can sow the seeds early, if you can till the soil early, the harvest just repeats and repeats and repeats.
That's so good. One of the other points she talks about is everything that we consume ends up forming us. And you say this a lot. We become what we behold. And she just talks about, you know, the social media that we consume, the books that we read, even the books that we've read a long time ago can come back and still impact us for positive or for negative. So it made me think about, we talk a lot at Them Before Us about divorce propaganda, the reels that we see about degrading your wife or degrading your husband. You know, you see these toxic Theo bro type people who think women basically shouldn't write tweets or speak outside the house at all, apparently. You know, if you just follow that content or you just follow the women influencers who talk about how much their husband sucks and how they have to carry the whole mental load, these things are going to form us, the books we read, the TV that we watch. And I think that's a really important thing as well.
I think it's interesting because you can hear there's ideological war between left and right. But in a lot of ways, there's ideological war within the right now as well. And it's interesting because I will hear people say a certain phrase, or I will hear them say, I attended this kind of event, or they will say something about themselves, how they identify or whatever. I can almost determine exactly what their news source is by how they speak. That's how tightly we are connected to our sources of information. Right? They form us in ways where we become like them, whether we want to or not. So I think it's a good lesson for all of us in 2026. Be really careful about what we're watching and listening and reading, because there are young people around us that are watching us and listening to us. And we want them to become like us as we become like Christ.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
Hey everyone, welcome. This is a segment we are going to call Here for the Comments. I'm Jen, training director with Them Before Us, and we're welcoming to the show our friend Sam of Pro-Life Sam fame. Sam, what are your handles on Instagram and Twitter?
Yes, it's @ProLife_Sam. So you can find me there. But I just joined the Them Before Us team as the communications manager, so I'm really excited to get started on these projects.
And it's been super fun. Sam and I are working together and we are in the comments a lot, which is why we decided to kind of do a new segment that will be on radio, our podcast, YouTube. Basically, we look at all the haters, the hateful comments. We put them into our staff chat and laugh about them and then decide how to make content and monetize it. So it's win-win for everyone, really. People feel heard and seen. And then we make money and laugh off their hateful comments. So, but it's pretty fun. And part of what we want to do with Here for the Comments is teach how to respond to some of the, you know, if there's genuine questions, genuine comments, of course we want to respond. And then some for the hater ones, we more just want to have a lighthearted posture toward it. So Sam, what was your idea to sort of celebrate the end of the year? How did you want to maximize some of the latest comments that we got?
You know, when I started doing pro-life activism, that when I got hate comments, I would feel so stressed and I would be like upset. And but now that I've been doing it for a long time, it's almost enjoyable because just they come out with like the craziest things. And so, yeah, I just decided we should do a 12 days of Christmas of hate comments. And each day we should do some of the top ones that we get, the craziest and most outrageous comments that we get sent in our inbox or under our posts.
Yeah, and most of these were collected from a post Katie just posted on her Facebook, which we did not expect to really. Sometimes Facebook is interesting. She put this on Twitter. It got basically nothing, no attention. She put it on her Facebook official page. It's at Katie Faust author, I believe, on Facebook. And I think we're almost to 6,000 comments now. Most of them horrible. And actually, the hilarious part is I learned how to filter them out. So they're just automatically being hidden by the C word. That took a majority of the trash out. And then all of the basic cuss words. So people have to get a little creative and put stars and different symbols in when they're trying to use bad language now, or no one ever sees it. They're just yelling at Katie into a void that nobody can see. So, but that's where the majority of our comments are. So if you want to go check it out and get in the comments, go to her Facebook and you'll see it. So this is the 12 Days of Christmas Children's Rights Activist Edition, or the 12 Haters of Christmas. And I have, I have number one. So while you're pulling up the other ones. Okay. On the first day of Christmas, our haters said to us, "I hope you choke on your Christmas dinner." I like too that you were pulling, you were kind of pulling along themes, because there's too many comments to do all of them. And wishing some sort of ill on Katie was a quite a prominent theme, but hoping you choke on your Xmas dinner, I guess, actually, was a big one.
Yeah.
One person said, "I hope you have a life full of waiting at the DMV and at red lights," or something like that. And I actually was like, that cracked me up. I thought that was kind of a very low-key, you disagree and you're being kind of mean, but a very low-key way to go about it. It's like, you know what? I respect it. This person just wants her to straight choke to death, so.
Yeah, yeah. And I love that they can't even write Christ. They have to say Xmas, because like I feel like it was the demon in them. They couldn't spell it out. So, yeah. I thought we'd bring that one in strong.
Yeah. That's our first one to lead off day one. Have you heard too that the X was a symbol for Christ, actually? I think in like the Greek or Roman times or something. So even the X to symbolize Christ is like what Christians used to do. So a lot of people think it's like the atheist thing, and it's like, oh no, you're actually still doing the Christian tradition. So, ooh, sorry about that. Okay, number two is a little more on the nose, not that inventive. Wait, what would you rate the first one on originality?
You know what? I would actually rate that one a good 8 out of 10. It was holiday themed. It was original. I liked it. I liked it.
I did that one with an emoji of like a turkey popping up. Looking around like, guys, like, oh no, don't do it. Okay. And then number two, you got that one.
Yes. Religious freaks. That one's original. That's new. I've never heard that before. There's not an entire song written about that specific, thing that people say about us, but, it was a little lazy. That's all I'll have to say about it. It's a little lazy.
Yeah. Jesus freaks. That's the DC talk. Did you grow up listening to DC talk?
You know, not really, just that one song, which tells you how popular that song was. So it cracks me up that that's the one thing that we do hear pretty often.
And the irony of it, I don't think in her post she talked about God at all. And, you know, Them Before Us is non-religious, non-partisan. Of course, those of us that work for Them Before Us are Christians. But the entire argument we're trying to make is based off biology. There's a man and a woman, they produce a child. That child has a right to both. Where did we talk about religion? And that's the only thing they can think of to dismiss it is, obviously, you guys are freaks, you're religious. And it's like, where did we talk about God at all?
I also love when they say, you don't need religion to be a good person. But then when we use religion to just basically stand up for children's rights and say you can't kill babies, then they're just like, you're religious freaks. It's like, maybe you do need religion a little.
Right. Yeah, we're going to put this one kind of low, I think. I would give it a, 1 or 2 out of 10. It's just basic. It's not even on theme, really. We didn't bring up religion. They brought it up, so. Okay, number three, F off and die. Did you edit this to say F?
Oh, yeah. Okay. I don't want to spell it out what it really said, but.
No, it's great. I actually was wondering if they self-edited to be slightly more appropriate. No, we did.
That was me. That's what I was thinking. I was like, I don't know who's reading this, so we all get the point here. So,
yeah, no,
this one I would give a little bit higher of a rating. It seems lazy, but it's the passion behind it that makes me excited, where it's like, it's not just like a simple, oh, you suck, or, you know, something like that. It is passionate. It is F off and die. So I feel like we hit a nerve with this person, you know?
Definitely. Yeah. But then there's like no punctuation, really. You're not really sharing more of what you think about the situation. But you're right. They're kind of combining two pretty common insults to F off and then to die. But they're like, you know what? I'm going to really spice it up and I'm going to put an and in there. That's our third day of Christmas. So I don't know. I'm going to say like 4 out of 10. Passion maybe, but I do find cursing pretty low brow in the sense of it can be done so humorously or emphatically in a way that cracks me up because I'm just not in that context very much. Homeschooled, raised in the church, but it's not even very, this isn't like humorous or very inventive, you know?
That's true. That's true.
Okay. Now this one's a little more interesting. This is day 4. Do you have that one?
Yep. Yep. It says, your kind is literally holding us back as a nation.
Which, okay, we have a lot to unpack here. Your kind. Now, yes. We're all humans. I think we're all humans. Yeah. They don't think we're all humans. Yeah. Progressives, right? You have to be born. You can't be too old. You can't be disabled. And then you can't have voted for Trump or be conservative at all, apparently. Okay, so you're less than human. But your kind, probably an ode back to religious freaks, would you think?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So the religious, you religious bigots are literally holding us back. We all use literally pretty much in the place where people use the F word, I think, you know, for emphasis.
Yep.
Holding us back as a nation. What do they mean by that?
Yeah, which is so funny because like religion usually is what progresses us morally. Like, we're the ones who are like, oh, how about we not have slaves? How about we treat children with dignity? How about we, you know, give women equal rights and basic care? Like, I feel like this is all Christian stuff. So I would argue that we push us forward pretty well as a nation.
Well, and that's what's so interesting is folks on the political left have taken the term progressive. So they took things that are pretty basic human realities, to be male, to be female, that marriage is between a man and a woman, it produces a child has a mother and a father, but we need to progress past that because there needs to be many kinds of families and love makes a family and all you need is love and let's use the word parents and that's progress, right? And a lot of people have talked about progress or going forward is not automatically a good thing. If you have a guardrail and you have a cliff and you have people that are like, go forward, progress, progress. It's like, no, that's death. We're all going to go over this cliff and die. Everybody stop. Like, what is this guardrail for before you decide to remove it? I think that was a Chesterton quote. Yeah. So the reality is Christianity has built society and progressivism is actually reverting us back to like Greek and Roman times when children got thrown out and killed or you know, child slavery, child sexual abuse. That's
child sacrifice.
Direction. Yeah, that's the direction we're going. It's actually back in time, not progress.
Yep. The next one, honestly, this is the one that I think, like, I'm not scared, but like, this was the one that was like the most intense in my mind because it said, end Katie Faust. Like, to me, that's just like a direct death threat. Like, I feel like you're not even trying to like hide it. You know, you're literally just saying to end her as a person. So I don't know. That one, I did want to add it on there, but that one probably needed to be reported to the FBI or something.
Yeah, seriously. The amount of death threats actually, and we're laughing about it here, but we'll skip through a little faster just because we're running out of time. But the next one, I genuinely hope you get hit by a car, a train, a rock, or a stray bullet, or anything else that will take your homophobic face off the earth. The next one. End bigots' lives. That goes back to if you can put people into a category, a political category, you can justify harming them, right? And the next one, this is day 8, make cancer and heart disease find you and your family swiftly. That's like a bit of a play off of people will be like, I hope your daughter or son is gay. Or just like, do you think that's a bad thing? Do you think that's an insult? Because why are you using it that way? But number 9. This was an interesting one.
So it says, some people are asking, how do we end Christianity? Simple, really. We criminalize it with a strong negative deterrent, such as the death penalty.
Make it.
Oh, no, they're trying to kill Christians again. This is so new.
And actually, that works so well in history and is working so well around the world. Even it's crazy Nigeria, where Christians are just being slaughtered. You think about Christmas Day, Easter Sunday, and Sunday, that's when Christians will get murdered. And you watch Nigerian Christians going and sitting in a bombed out church for their Sunday morning service again, knowing that people died there a week earlier. They'll go back to church the next Sunday. So actually, the kind of pressure that gets applied to Christians around the world when they think that threatening people with death slows it down, that's what Romans figured out real quick too. I mean, even at the bottom of the barrel, being murdered, mass murdered in the Colosseum, which someone commented, I used to feel bad for Christians getting killed in the Colosseum. Now I understand it. That was one of the comments in the Obergefell one that I remember seeing. But it never ends the way they think. Christianity thrives under pressure and heat because nobody's doing it for fake, you know? So pretty crazy.
Yep.
The 10th date of haters.
Yeah. I liked this one. The fact that you made your little image rainbow color shows the true, deep, inner evil that is within you. Disgusting. It's like, I actually thought that was hilarious because they're like, oh, you're using the rainbow to be against gay rights, which is hilarious because you're using the rainbow, which God made as a promise to his people. And you're the one who twisted that into gay rights somehow. So you guys stole the rainbow first. All right. We're taking it back. Yeah, all right. This was ours. So if you're talking about this deep inner evil because you stole something, well, you're the one who stole it first. So how deeply evil are you?
Seriously. And the rainbow was literally a promise, a promise that God wasn't going to destroy humans again via flood for their horrible wickedness and evil against him. The irony of them using the rainbow to celebrate pride, a sin, and celebrate wickedness and rebellion against God. Isn't it ironic? Oh, here we go. Another one. Not very original. Drink bleach. Okay. This one, though. Seriously. Yeah, this one stood out. You are the reason we need more Tyler Robinsons, this guy who killed Charlie Kirk, allegedly killed Charlie Kirk on trial. You should do a public outdoor speaking tour so we can all watch it happen. This is progressivism in a nutshell. They don't have good arguments. Very few people commented a good argument. You have like 20 seconds. Any final thoughts on our 12 haters of Christmas?
You know, I wish them all well. I pray for them, and I hope that their lives get a little bit better so they don't have to spend their time commenting really awful things on strangers' Facebook pages.
And that's what it is. Hey, we're going to do more here for the comments in the future. I teach you how to reply to the haters. But we hope you had a wonderful Christmas, a great new year, and we will catch all of you in our next segment, whether it's radio, podcast, or YouTube. See you guys soon.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.